Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. Delighted to welcome our special guests to the podcast session today, Vince New, who's Associate VP Programmatic and Data Strategy for APAC with Essence out in Singapore. Hey, Vince, how are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Not at all. Our pleasure. And over in the Waltham So studio is Lindsay Rowntree.
Hi there.
I didn't actually forget your name there, Lindsay. I just got momentarily distracted by, all the crazy background that you've got in the Waltham So studio.
You see, if you had forgotten my name, I wouldn't have been surprised. So, yeah.
Yep.
But I appreciate my background is quite crazy.
Yeah, it's definitely very, very dynamic.
That is one way of putting it, Vince. Yeah.
Amazing. Right. Let's get into this week's news stories. Actually, it was a pretty interesting week in the world of news for advertising and marketing tech, and we're not even scraping the surface. I've just chosen three stories. First up is the news coming through that Norwegian e-com and classifieds platform Adevinta has purchased eBay's classifieds business. This is, particularly interesting because it follows months of speculation. We know that eBay's been trying to sell its classified business for some time now, and we know that Adevinta were one of the interested parties amongst a few others, it feels like an interesting time for this deal to be closing. Of course, Adevinta is owned by Norwegian publisher Schibsted, who has quite a lot of properties across the region, and Adevinta itself as a platform is accessible in a lot of countries throughout Europe. So adding eBay's classified business to their offering turns that into a pretty large classifieds business. Part of the pressure for eBay to offload their classifieds business was coming from investors who wanted them to rationalize what they sort of perceived to be a sprawling business, where they had their e-com marketplace, PayPal, their classifieds business, and then Viagogo, the ticketing platform, which of course was sold to StubHub last year. And strangely, in sort of sideline connected news, that's under competition scrutiny, actually, that deal at the moment. But anyway, this is obviously eBay managing to achieve that aim of divesting of the classifieds business, and it feels like a really interesting time for that to be happening. So want to hear your thoughts on this, Vince and Lindsay, particularly interested in any e-com perspective you've got on this. Vince, over there in APAC, e-com's obviously as a business has experienced quite a surge this year, and I know that interesting things are happening with some of APAC's e-com players, but of course also interested in your perspective on the classifieds business and how valuable this will be to Adevinta and what it does to eBay's offering going forward without the classifieds business. So yeah, give us your perspective, Vince.
Yeah, sure. I think the first thing is, people are asking, e-commerce platforms have seen a big boost during this time, eBay included, for the core business. And I guess the question is, as this, time goes on and we move more into a new normal, I don't think it's fair to say we'll revert. I don't think that's right. I think that's quite accurate. But if we move towards a new normal, are these kind of, lifts and activity from an e-commerce standpoint going to sustain itself? And I think the answer is definitely yes. I think Black Swan events generally have long-lasting consequences, and the pandemic definitely counts as one. But essentially, you're dramatically altering people's lifestyles, which will alter their habits, and habits are pretty hard to break. So, definitely here in APAC, and I would imagine everywhere, brands are putting in, brands and platforms are putting in a lot of time, effort and resources into developing their e-commerce presence, whether it's doubling down what they already have or kickstarting new initiatives. And that also applies to the infrastructure that supports, right? So there's, lots of new platforms being built. For example, in Singapore, CapitaLand, which is one of Asia's largest real estate groups, they just announced, and they own like a number of large malls across Singapore, right? And they just announced last week that they're introducing a new e-commerce platform to feature their retailers, and that takes a lot of work. And then around logistics, most of these platforms, had challenges with meeting the added demands of the products that were coming out the shelves. So, they've had to change a lot of things from a logistical standpoint. And all those changes, I don't think will, you know, go back to the way it was. Like, there's, you know, too much work has been put in, right? And usually what happens, I think, is, you know, all the infrastructure and all those features and all those new things that are meant to entice consumers, that's going to, you know, kind of create a circular, I guess, a circular equation where you have changes in consumer habits, behaviors, and that leads to brands providing more functionality. And then that new functionality further shapes the behavior or maintains the behavior, even if things somewhat revert. So I think, and just from a pure e-commerce standpoint, I think a lot of these changes and whatnot are here to stay.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's really interesting that Capital Land are branching into e-com, because like you say, anyone that's ever spent even 5 minutes in Singapore will notice their logo everywhere. They've got such a big footprint when it comes to shopping malls. And, you know, I guess that is a big dilemma for physical real estate owners, is how do we you know, convert this business to some kind of a digital platform? So that's a really interesting move. Just tell me a little bit about your perspective on the classifieds business, because of course this, you know, this in part is about eBay divesting of that classifieds business. What kind of value do you think it's going to add to Adevinta's sort of already existing classifieds business? And what's interesting is that they're going to be running that alongside their e-com business. And that's what we've known eBay for, right? We've always known them as a marketplace plus a classifieds business. Yeah. What's your point of view on that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because they're essentially, eBay is moving away from that model and giving it to Adevinta in some way, right? They're moving away from this e-com, core e-com bundled with the classifieds, and Adevinta is moving into that. And obviously it increases Adevinta's footprint, and they're going to be, you know, their entire classifieds platform, if you want to call it, even though it's kind of decentralized, will be across all these countries. And my opinion is that, I don't think classifieds by nature is, you know, is a format or the type of platform that scales in a synergistic way across markets. I see classifieds as being, you know, highly local and kind of a personal type of interaction point, right? So, for example, you know, you're using classifieds in Singapore, take care. So, you know, the folks in Singapore are much more likely to use a local app that connects them with local, you know, users than they are to go to, like, say, like an eBay to get something locally within Singapore. At the same time, though, like the times when they would go to eBay, it'd be for something, you know, overseas or something very, very specific that they can't get in Singapore. So, and I think a lot of times, you know, with eBay's classifieds business, there were multiple platforms that each focused on various countries and whatnot. So it's quite local in nature. So I do see the acquisition. It would certainly add to Adevinta's you know, scale, but I don't see it being like a force multiplier in the sense that various pieces will work together. Because again, I think consumers don't interact with classifieds in that kind of fashion.
Yeah, interesting. Lindsay, what's your perspective?
Yeah, it's interesting to follow on from Vince's point. I think I agree with him in the sense that will this give Adevinta this massive play? Can they start combining forces in all these different markets? And if you look at the way Adevinta is set up at the moment, probably not. Like, what Adevinta currently is in 15 markets, and they're strongest. They've got multiple different brands and platforms in France, Spain, Hungary, and Ireland. And then they've got just Shpock, the boot sale app, in just Germany and UK. And what if you look at what Adevinta are doing and where the different brands, they've even got brands in North Africa, like Morocco and Tunisia, but only certain brands apparently seem to work in certain markets. And so you can't just take the eBay classifieds business and then lump all those same brands into those markets Adevinta already operates in. So eBay classifieds looks like it will give them a big diversification in terms of brands, in terms of market reach. So where Adevinta aren't big in Germany and the UK, eBay classifieds will help them with that, with like the likes of Gumtree and the likes of eBay Kleinanzeigen, which is eBay classifieds. But I don't necessarily think that I'd be interested to see how they merge them together, and in terms of how it would help their publisher business. I've been trying to find out, kind of, because I read somewhere that eBay's because the part of the deal is eBay getting like 540 million shares, and that means that eBay will then have a 44% stake in Adevinta. Schibsted used to have 59% stake. eBay will now have the controlling stake, and Schibsted will move down to something like 33%. But they'll both have equal voting rights, which means I don't think Schibsted will have any play when it comes to using eBay Classifieds purchase in any of its publishing business and looking at its data assets. And I wonder how Adevinta currently uses its data assets across different platforms, across different brands, to be able to inform one or the other. I imagine they probably don't, because they probably can't, and maybe the users look so different that it's not possible to do that. And I feel like eBay being brought into the mix may not make much difference to them in the first place. But I feel like there could be, in terms of monetization, in terms of advertising, there could definitely probably be synergies brought across in different, where there are similar brands like Spock versus Gumtree, similar brands brought together, they can probably kind of find efficiencies in how they advertise, how they monetize. But I kind of think at the moment, not that much is going to really happen. Like, I can't really see how it can, because Adevinta is basically just adding more brands like that it already has into its portfolio. And as far as I can tell, there isn't much joined up thinking going on with them already, probably because they can't be.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point, because I should have mentioned actually in the intro, the deal is valued at $9.2 billion, but as you rightly say, Lindsay, it's a mixture of cash and shares. So in a way, you know, eBay is actually getting even more out of this, because it will then get that controlling voting stake in the overall business. And the other thing that I found interesting about this, and particularly interested in your point of view on this, Vince, is that if you stand back and look at all of the various parts of eBay's business, it feels like you could argue they're a bit of an early adopter of this model of marketplace, classifieds, payment functionality. You know, then they had their ticketing functionality as well, which would have given them an awful lot of customer data across those profiles. And I'm thinking about, the sort of synergies with the likes of what we tend to refer to as those super utility apps, which are born in Asia, whether that's in China or Southeast Asia through Grab and Gojek, initially starting out as ride hailing platforms, but really looking to expand, their portfolio of businesses. And I know they do that by expanding their brand and developing new products. But it's quite interesting that eBay shareholders were saying, no, actually, we want you to simplify the business. The diversification is the thing that we think is becoming messy. Whereas those super utility platforms in Asia are looking at it from the other side of the coin altogether. Now, I know we're not kind of comparing like for like here, but it's an interesting point of view from shareholders saying we want simplicity rather than diversity. But surely from a customer data point of view, that diversity is perhaps more valuable. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think it's, definitely not apples to oranges, or definitely not apples to apples, I'm sorry.
Most definitely apples to oranges, you're right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it's, the thing with, in my opinion for eBay, let's look at the last 10 years, right? For example, like they were, one of the, the big brands coming out of the dot-com era, completely, frank, they haven't generated a lot of value in the last 10 years, certainly not relative to, some of the competitors, and their peers from that time. Right. And, all those acquisitions they've taken, whether it's the classifieds and stuff, a lot of those things, I'll speak to classifieds specifically it certainly made sense at the time, in the early web, the way people, use classifieds, for lack of a better term, was very different. What they expected out of a classified ad is very different. And back then, adding text and dynamic images made classifieds, way more interesting than the classifieds they would get from the newspapers, for example. And then at the same time, you can argue that the audience that would be using the classifieds is much closer to the audience that uses eBay proper, like the auctions, et cetera. Whereas I think because of the evolution of what classifieds are in these days, so for example, like whether it's the new forms of e-commerce, people going to social networking apps for those kind of functionalities, like what users expect out of a classifieds interaction is quite different. And I don't believe that eBay's classifieds model has changed much to adapt to that. So as a result, you have this thing where the people that use eBay, it's a very different audience than the people that still use the classifieds ad. So there isn't much synergy to be gained. So even if there was more data, more data and it's good. But there's not, I don't think there was a force multiplier, halo effect of that. And at the same time, the only part of the eBay's business that was generating value is the core side of the business. And right now, given you know, they've seen an uptick for the first time in a really long time due to, you know, stay at home measures. You know, it makes sense for them to strike when the iron's hot and to divest themselves of the, you know, the parts of the business that, you know, aren't generating very much value.
Yeah, I think Vince, you touched on it earlier. You mentioned that, you know, the local aspect of classifieds, and actually in a world where globalization is just becoming more and more of a thing, is the classifieds business actually, does it have longevity anymore? Like, is there, you know, if you could buy anything from anywhere and have it shipped the next day, and that's where eBay marketplace is still seeing massive growth, because I can buy anything from anywhere in my country. I can also buy things internationally and get them shipped over. But the likes of Gumtree or the likes of Shpock, everything has to be, you know, within it depends how far you're willing to travel, but let's say 15, 20 mile radius in the UK, for example. And actually in a world where things are being globalized so rapidly, is that local aspect as important as it used to be? And does that make classifieds more difficult sell? Like I got my calculator out, and the classifieds business is 13% of eBay's marketplace business in terms of revenue. So it's a tiny fraction. And in terms of shareholders wanting to make sure that eBay is extracting the most value out of things, I can understand why it felt like eBay marketplace was probably too much resource for the amount of revenue it's bringing in. But then the flip side of that, of course, is COVID, and COVID creating these, you know, what was it, their 15-minute communities. So things are becoming much more local, and maybe going and buying something from a neighbor around the corner, and using things like Facebook Marketplace and using things like Shpock is becoming a much bigger thing than it used to be, because people are willing to travel only a very short distance and probably aren't willing to go to the post office to go and send them.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Either not willing to travel very far or not able to, right? And so it's really bringing back that notion of the local marketplace, and potentially something that's going to be sustained for quite a while, not least of all because we're in an environment, no matter what country you live in, where we're sort of living in a slightly restricted fashion, but also too because people are going to want to hold on to the positive elements that that those restrictions have instigated in terms of behavior change. There's a lot more that we could say on this one, but I'm going to move us on to the next story. So this is actually a piece of news from a couple of weeks ago now, which I found particularly interesting. That is South China Morning Post, which is a Hong Kong publication, becoming the first news media publisher in Asia to launch their own targeting and activation platform using their first-party data. So this is, potentially in response to the declining availability of third-party cookies across major browsers, and also in response to data privacy requirements as a result of various government regulations across a number of regions and international areas. So SCMP have emphasised that, they're wanting to make the most of their first-party data and turn it into, a platform, but also a product that marketers and advertisers can feel confident in using when wanting to target audiences. It's the sort of thing that at Exchange Why we've been chatting about for a long time, right, which is that publishers needed to get much closer to their first-party data, needed to find ways to activate it and make it available in terms of, inventory and audience segments, and they needed to be the owners of that transition and change. So it's pretty exciting move for South China Morning Post. It's going to be something that no doubt they've been working on for a while, but it feels like a really good time for them to be launching it as well, right? Right in the middle of us talking about and experiencing the decimation of the third party cookie. So fascinated to hear your point of view on this, Vince. They stated in their press release that they're the first, Asian news media platform to be doing this. Really interested to know if you've got any views on whether others are going to follow suit and what the sort of response to this is in the APAC region.
Yeah, this is a super super topical one, I think, for us in the industry. I can't speak for all the solutions that the various publishers are working on. I'm sure everyone's being very industrious, but this type of solution is, from a news publisher, is the first one that I've come across in APAC. And it's pretty clear they've done a lot of done a lot of thinking. I think I was reading an article, and Ian Hawking mentioned that they've been working on this for the past 12 months. It's quite future proof, right? And I like that they're shooting for that quote unquote single customer view holy grail there, which is obviously it's something that becomes more and more relevant given the focus around first party data and especially for publishers from a monetization standpoint. I think generally a true, single cluster view is quite hard, but even a more singular view is always a good thing. And in terms of, in terms of what we've seen from other publishers in the region, in speaking with, publishers in Australia, we're seeing spiritually similar efforts from the larger AU publishers like the Nines and News Corps. They're actively making efforts to, bolster the first party data with persistent identifiers and logins to future proof. I think the other thing is that, and this kind of is a little bit different than what SCMP is offering, but I think the other thing in response to what's deprecation cookies is that publishers and the whole industry needs to become more comfortable with the idea that data doesn't necessarily have to be programmatically addressable to be powerful and valuable. So for example, if a publisher is able to generate insights from their data and make it available to marketers and advertisers, in a way that allows them to inform their tactics and strategy, that's incredibly compelling. It's not a direct application, but you can still get a lot of, a lot of learnings from that. And it's not something I think most publishers have actively done, in this region. I think the best example I've seen in the region, but it's a global company, is with Spotify. I know Diogo was on the podcast last week, so I'm not trying to give them too much push or anything. yeah, I'm not trying to give them free content, but they have a dashboard that marketers can log into and generate insights about audiences and Spotify listener data, and music is one of the few services that where the data generated can be used as a proxy for mood and emotion. Right, that's really rare. So those insights are very, very powerful and fills a gap for marketers. And I think that sort of thinking is quite untapped, as a space in general. And more, publishers, as we move into a world where direct addressability is a little bit tougher, especially across sites, that's something that I'd like to see more publishers in this region, make an effort to provide.
Yeah. And what about the push from brands and marketers on this? Is there one? How do they understand the importance of, being able to buy sort of audiences that are completely based on first party data? Do they understand how, what the deprecation of third party cookies is doing to their, potentially to their marketing campaigns? What's your perspective?
Yeah, I think it depends on the brand. I'm painting with a really broad brush here, because it's just my interactions and my aperture. But the sense I get is that for brands in APAC, it's not nearly as top of mind as it is, I would say, for brands in EMEA and the US. And this is not just third-party cookies, right? This is everything that goes with the, you want to call it the degradation of digital identity as we used to know it, IDFA-BNX. And I think part of the reason for that is, with GDPR in EMEA and then CCPA in the US, it's made the brands quite sensitive in those regions to these developments. So you can't really, if you're in this industry, you can't get away from it, right? It was such a big topic, and everyone was preparing for it. But the impact, and because there hasn't been that sort of regulation of that scale in APAC, with maybe the exception of AU, where folks are, it's more Western markets, so folks are quite tuned in there. I think as a result, it's just not nearly as top of mind for clients in APAC. And I think the other thing is that, along the same lines of, the impact of IDFA and the ITP on Safari, is that iOS smartphone share in APAC is only 10 to 15% in most markets, right? It's much, much less. And again, Australia is the main exception, with Japan to a lesser extent. So while most brands in the US and UK are really, really sensitive to the ability to target users with iPhones, the same might not be said for some markets in APAC. I would say that's kind of my assessment in terms of how brands are reacting. But that at the same time, though, in terms of our clients, it's certainly, this sort of conversation is certainly something we're quite forthright and proactive in having. And it's more of a thing where, and certain clients are more, more plugged in and informed than others. But what we're trying to do is working together with them to, make sure that the client and we're prepared for, a future without third party cookies, and maybe, a very stripped down IDFA. So we have various initiatives around education awareness, around the policies and then the changes to the systems itself, whether it's browsers and apps. Then based on those changes, you know, we can, you know, make and devise solutions to help mitigate the risk. For example, with DTLogs ending, we're migrating clients over to Ads Data Hub and doing more work in data clean rooms and looking towards measurement solutions that might circumvent. So for example, starting to test out panel-based solutions because impression retargeting is going away. And that's how we used to do brand surveys, right? And right now, as we speak, you know, given the latest developments with the IDFA, you know, we're basically doing a wholesale collection of historical data to get a sense of how much iOS we do run by market and what type of KPIs are attached to it. So then we can start getting a sense of the impact and making decisions from there. So it's, for us, it's definitely a conversation we're taking to our brands, you know, whether or not it's something that's top of mind, it's something that's quite top of mind for us. And we want to make sure that our clients are in the best position possible.
Yeah, that's really interesting sort of whistle-stop tour of what's happening in APAC under that banner. Lindsay, what's your point of view on this story?
I think it's really interesting. And we had Ian Hocking write for us on Exchange Wire back in April, where he was kind of teeing up this news and talking about the integration of the third-party cookie and what that means for publishers. And his stance back then was that he's not really seeing many ID solutions out in the Asia market. And he's disappointed by that. And, you know, put an open invitation for a chat with like-minded individuals to kind of discuss what is going on and what publishers can do. And I think that one of the reasons that South China Morning Post is ahead of the curve in terms of APAC publishers, it's probably because it has a very international audience. It has a strong US and European audience. And if you look at what, as Vince, you just said, if you look at what is happening in the US and EMEA, where these conversations are more prevalent, it's because of things like GDPR and CCPA that have already got us prepared for a world where the cookie might you know, might not be the panacea that it has been for us in the past. So we're already kind of in progress of making that a thing. And actually in Asia, it's not so big yet. I mean, we spoke about identity and the third-party cookie at ATS Singapore last year. And it was a conversation that everybody loved and said it was really interesting, but nobody really had the conversation in Singapore yet. Whereas we've been having that conversation in Europe at ATS events for the past year. And in Singapore, it's still quite a nascent conversation. So I think because they've not had to yet, no one's pushed it. And Vince, I'm interested in the things you're talking about, kind of all the different plans you've got in place to try and help brands understand it, things like panel-based solutions, data clean rooms. Is this, clearly, based on what you said, isn't being led by your clients because it probably isn't front of mind for them yet. But is it a global conversation? Is it something being led by you locally? Who has decided this is the approach we're going to take to having this conversation with our clients and trying to kind of get ahead of the curve?
That depends on the client. Some clients that are global in nature, where the conversations are global in nature as well, where, you know, APAC brings a perspective, EMEA does as well, and North America does also. And we land on solutions that are, you know, as much as possible, you know, I was going to say lowest common denominator, but that's the opposite of what I meant. What I meant is the best solution that works for everybody as much as possible is what I've been trying to say. So that's one example. But then we do have clients that are, you know, local for APAC, where it's a conversation we're having on a local level. And I think, you know, one thing that we're careful to do is to modulate the conversation based on the needs for the client, right? So depending on, you know, the type of business they are, you know, the type of, I guess, like infrastructure they have and the readiness they have and kind of what we're doing currently, you know, the nature of the conversations and the solutions and the roadmap that we put in place will be a little bit different, right? But regardless, it's a lot of it is, I'll touch upon it a little bit later when we get to the Q&A, but a part of it is, you know, helping them extract the maximum value of what they have based on the conditions today, but also at the same time, in parallel, building a bridge towards something that will work in the future. Because I think one thing we don't want to do is move everybody towards this future state that isn't quite developed and hasn't really resolved itself yet at the expense of generating value with what is still viable. So we're trying to walk that tight line with the clients. And it does require quite a bit of education, but that's part of the role we play in these kind of conversations.
Yeah. Go on, Lindsay. You're going to say something.
It's interesting, and hearing you talk about that, Vince, kind of it reminds you that a big part of this, a big play of this, is actually what brands and marketers, agencies, publishers have been trying to do for a while is make sure that they are bringing those relationships back together, where it's been separated quite drastically by technology over the past decade. It's now about bringing those relationships closer together and ensuring that brands and publishers are working better together. And also, what SEMP have done reminds me of JP Politikerhus in Denmark with their data platform Relevance. And we had Thomas Lutzen speak at ATS Stockholm back in February. And again, it was fascinating. And hearing saying publishers need to take control. We can't rely on anybody else. This is not nobody really knows what is down the line. We don't know when Google are going to introduce this. So it's up to us to make sure that we are not relying on anybody else, because only we can fix this. And we have the necessary assets to be able to do so. And what South China Morning Post are trying to do, they know what they've got, they know what they can use. It's this mixture of first party data plus the declared data from the polls and everything else that they have on their sites, on their properties. I think it's really interesting. And I think that, for SEMP working with brands, it'll be an interesting proposition that they will want to go for.
Yeah. I think the other really important point that you made there, Vince, as well, is that sometimes this is about a transition at a point in time, right? So you can prepare people, perhaps prepare your advertisers and your marketers, your clients for it. But even from the publisher point of view, they can be working in the background to try to get themselves ready for this. But they need to make the transition when it's sensible and the right time to do it, right? And so it feels like we have been talking about this for a while in various regions at ATS events, but now's the time that we're actually starting to see the changes unfold. So it's going to be really interesting next 6 to 12 months, especially because we speculated at the beginning of this sort of year that maybe the pandemic situation might distract people from, part of the day job, which for publishers at the moment has got to be organising their first party data assets and how they make use of those. But this is an example of where it hasn't been distracting from the day job, which is good. Thailand Siam Commercial Bank is launching a food delivery service, which feels like a bit of a challenge to the super utility apps we mentioned earlier on in the piece, who were really big in terms of food delivery across the Southeast Asian region. I'm speaking about Grab and Gojek. What I thought was really interesting about this particular product that SCB is launching is that they're evidently trying to entice customers onto their platform by waiving commission fees to restaurant owners and hoping to gain those restaurateurs and also customers and consumers that are using the platform as new banking customers. So loaning funds to them and potentially selling them other financial and banking products. I thought this was also interesting because it's obviously a direct challenge to Gojek and Grab, who are looking to set up their own financial services in those marketplaces. And it feels like it's a bit of a nod as well to that traditional banking business model trying to become more digitized and trying to find other ways to reach their customers across different platforms, doing that by launching an entirely different service that is clearly not in their kind of area of expertise or wheelhouse traditionally. And it reminded me a little bit, Lindsay, of chatting with BBVA, the Spanish bank, at ATS Madrid last year, where we were chatting away with Ruth Zora, who works for Mindshare and BBVA, saying that their perspective as a commercial retail bank was that they viewed their competition not as other retail banks, but as Amazon, the likes of Amazon. They wanted to be a platform that provided a plethora of services to their customers. It's just that principal point of relationship was through banking. And that's what this move reminded me of. So actually, I'm going to throw to Lindsay first and then go to Vince. What did you think about this story, Lindsay?
I think it's really interesting. And I think that from a super utility app perspective, what interests me about it is that we spoke about, the likes of Grab and Gojek recently, and Siam Bank are going back to front. So the likes of Grab and Gojek go into these low-cost delivery services because they're low barriers to entry, they're low-cost, and it enables them to get a massive market share to then be able to go into the businesses that have higher barriers to entry, but at this point they've got a massive customer base. So they can go into the finance industry with this massive customer base and offer these loyal customers something for nothing in terms of, they're already loyal. What this is doing is trying to use this to get into to get into restaurants and go backwards to offer these low cost services. But I don't feel like they're doing it from the consumer perspective. It doesn't. It sounds like they couldn't really give a crap about the consumers. Mm. It's about the business side of things. So they're trying to get restaurant data, and if they can, it's actually a very clever way of doing vertical integration. If they can use that data to understand what orders they're getting in, how frequently they're getting customers, they can then use that data to understand if they are risky or not when it comes to lending them money. And that I find interesting. That's a really interesting way of doing it. And it reminds me, there's a company in North America. It's either Canadian or from the US, called ClearBank or ClearBonk. It's a bit of a weird, it's kind of more e-commerce technology. But the way they work is that they plug into your Facebook advertising platform or your AdWords platform, and they can see your revenue and they can see your advertising, and they will give you funding based on what you're getting through. And this sounds like a similar thing. So they will give you funding as a business, and you can use them as a credit card, do whatever you like. So it is like a banking service, but it's purely based on how you're performing as a business, and they have direct access to how you're performing. So there's no hoodwinking it. And this sounds very similar to that. Like, we can see exactly how your business is doing. So based on that criteria, we will lend you X amount. And there's no real other way of doing that when it comes to kind of banking. You're sort of going on, yes, paperwork, but also gut feel. There's a million forms to fill in. This to me seems like a fascinating way of doing, of transforming B2B lending. And that's what I find interesting about it.
I didn't think about the risk element. That's a really good point, a risk assessment. Vince, what did you think?
Yeah, I echo a lot of Lindsay's sentiments. I found it super interesting from the lens of, there's, you know, a lot of talk about traditional banks, should they be going digital? If so, how do we go about it? And I think, you know, the answer is, you know, the banks have to be smart and have a clear and viable strategy, but also the tech and operational infrastructure to tactically execute this strategy, right? And I think in this case, it's quite clear, and it's quite, you know, to Lindsay's point, quite clever. I mean, they have the capital, I assume, to undercut the competition completely, and at the same time address a really acute topical pain point, as in, like, commission fees are hammering the restaurants that are already hammered by COVID, so they can take care of that. But at the same time, this is just a means to an end, right? To the point of the article, you know, they want to increase lending opportunities with restaurants. And then the way they mitigate what's, I guess, historically a pretty, high or risky business to be lending to is to use the data generated from this app to figure out who they should be lending to. So the creative positive feedback loop. So it's quite clever and quite smart. And I think that's how banks need to go in, or traditional banks need to approach going digital. They can't just decide we're going digital and compete with the Grab and Go Jix. They need to find an angle, to insert themselves. And it's, I just thought it was really, really fascinating. But I think the potential kind of counterattack would be interesting too. But in terms of what SCB is doing, it's quite clever.
That's the thing. What would the counterattack be like, right? Because you could say, from the Grab and Go Jix point of view, okay, they're not financial institutions. So they're not even, I imagine they're not even, you know, they're not even necessarily going to be able to offer like for like products. They're not necessarily going to be loaning commercial businesses money. Well, maybe not at this stage anyway. It might've been something they're working up towards. But are they likely to have richer customer data? But then again, does that really matter? Because maybe from a bank's perspective, you know, there's more margin in the products that they're potentially offering, right? There's got to be more of a return on a commercial loan than there is on, a delivery service, or I don't know. And also, I wondered, we've been talking about this a little bit with respect to how utility apps have been evolving in Asia versus, say, the US or European markets, which are very heavily regulated from a financial point of view. So it's not just easy thing to do, for example, Uber, to just set up a payment card or a credit card system, because financial banking regulations are really quite, you know, full on in most European countries and in the US. So is there an advantage here in Asia that, you know, SCB might have a little bit more access, but also they've still got the financial structure and institutions. So presumably they're really good at, data security and, you know, personal data management. Not saying that Grab and Go Jix aren't either, but maybe they've got the upper hand here. I don't know. What do you think the counterattack's going to be for Grab and Go Jix?
Yeah, I think, the first thing is, I mean, based on everything we just said, I think we're kind of playing different games here. It looks like on a surface, it looks like the territory of Grab and Go Jix are being encroached on, but SCB's got, again, it's a means to an end, right? So, you know, they may not even you know, they may not even be playing the same game, but if we pretend they are, you know, I would imagine Grab Gocheck would, you know, counterattack and respond in kind, and they'll enter more into the financial turf of the banks with the financial products like loans and whatnot. You know, banking on the fact that A, they were born in the digital world and we can wield our data better than you can because we've been doing it longer. And then B, leverage the, I guess, the brand halo of being unicorn. You know, I would imagine that's also something that they want to leverage. But, and this is already happening, right? Grab is partnered with the bank of Ayuya, a subsidiary of, I think Mitsubishi in Japan, to start lending to restaurants in May. And both have entered into the e-payments and insurance. So they are kind of encroaching into the space as well. But I think one thing that's interesting is that, you know, companies like Grab, Grab specifically, you know, they may run into challenges with the government. You know, there's been resistance to Grab in Thailand. And I think for a long time, Grab was technically illegal in Thailand, but still operating openly. And, you know, this is changing because I think the government is taking steps to legalize Grab services. And I haven't checked recently, but last I heard, it was supposed to be effective in around March or so, starting with Grab's ride hailing service. But there's a government factor because the Thai government heavily favors like local startups and, you know, funding and tax breaks and whatnot through, you know, their national innovation agency. So I wouldn't be surprised if Robinhood, the app, the bank's putting forth, you know, gains traction, you know, due to, you know, government support over like foreign owned entities like Grab, even if it's just a means to an end.
Yeah. Interesting. Any final words on that, Lindsay?
I think it's interesting you saying about Grab being illegal in Thailand. It reminds me of Uber cabs being illegal in London and then still just running as normal. But yeah, I think there'll be interesting play here. And if the likes of Grab and Gojek are going into the business side of things as well, it makes a lot of sense because they have the business data. There's a lot they can do with that. And maybe that means that SEB will also go into the consumer side of things. Like actually, they're doing this for the B2B data, for the restaurant data, is for lending opportunities, but as an accidental byproduct of this, they will also have a ton of consumer data that they could then decide to use in their favor. Or I don't know how they would use it, but that, you know, there could be some value to that as well, because if they can make it work, and if Grab is obviously being openly used, but you know, potentially if it's a local company could overtake Grab in terms of popularity with consumers and with restaurants. So it could be really interesting for them and a very fascinating thing to watch, I think.
Yeah, interesting times for sure. And it's just the thing that I've loved about the trajectory of Grab and Gojek is particularly Grab. It's, you know, it's become an international phenomenon, right? Like people on the other side of the world talk about it. And I just find that really interesting because, you know, they perhaps started out as unicorns and sort of the local versions of Uber, and Grab in particular has just grown to become this multifaceted company. Which just speaks to the sophistication of those markets. So it's a really interesting story to watch from, you know, from outside the region. Right, you know, we're getting tight on time. So let's move on to having a bit of a chat, Vince, with you about what you're working on at the moment at Essence. You've already alluded to it a little bit, but tell us what you're focusing on at the moment and maybe the ways in which your role is evolving a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we're focusing on very much on developing and, I guess, augmenting capabilities that broadly fall under the term data strategy, right? I mean, it's a very broad term. It could mean anything. And those, the development and growth of those capabilities for APAC, you know, those are responsibilities that I've taken on with my remit. And I think, you know, the reason for this is, you know, data is, you know, more integral to more aspects of our clients' businesses, but it's also like never been more complex and confusing. And I think in APAC, there's more questions around it because there hasn't been as much, you know, dialogue as, you know, as there has been in the UK or North America with the regulation coming. And it's manifesting what clients are asking, both existing clients as well as prospective clients. So a lot of these capabilities, you know, they're not necessarily traditional media agency services, right? So they're oftentimes more consultative in nature. So it include anything from, you know, helping brands better govern and understand the origins of their data, how it's stored and managed, and then the opportunities. It can be around data-driven planning and segmentation, you know, taking all the signals that they're you know, their the clients generate, and then how to use it for upstream insight generation, ideation, as well as, you know, addressable audience for actual, you know, programmatic targeting. And then another one is data acquisition, so helping them identify trustworthy value-adding data from external partners. And this isn't necessarily just standard third-party, you know, data sets that you use for targeting, right? This can include aggregated representative or syndicated research that you can marry with that. So it gets quite broad. And then lastly, tech stack strategies, helping clients better define the optimal platform architecture to support their business goals. And that's quite topical right now, just because there's a lot of changes in terms of what the MarTech, AdTech stack looks like, or how it's going to look given all the changes. So there's a lot of appetite to get some, more information from this aspect.
And to what extent have some of those sort of, you know, offerings under the data strategy element of your job title just sort of happened organically, you know, because of clients' needs and because maybe you've started these conversations with clients over time? Or has it been, and how much of it has been a deliberate maneuver? I guess it links a little bit to what you were saying earlier. Some clients you're probably having quite advanced conversations with, and they might be leading that a little bit. Other clients you're performing more of an education role, and you're trying to kind of, you know, bring them to the conversation. But I'm just interested in what the mix is there for you.
Yeah, I mean, probably a bit of a cop-out answer, but it's a bit of both. I mean, it's something that we were actively developing more of. You know, I think, you know, again, data strategy, the word itself is quite broad, and the capabilities I just described, you know, they carry across multiple domains, right? It covers ad ops, covers strategy, programmatic activation, analytics. And the idea with, you know, these capabilities is we're trying to, by design, break down silos and provide solutions for brands that are more turnkey and holistic, but also modular, depending on what the client needs, and not be constrained by traditional boundaries. So there's an aspect of uniting various streams that maybe lived more in silos before, you know, through the kind of services we provide. But in terms of, you know, whether or not this is more spurred by client ask, you know, we certainly, the clients are acutely asking for us to help them with, for example, better validating the technology, or for example, if they're looking to kick off and forming a data strategy, or looking into pieces of technology to augment the use of the data assets. You know, those are the asks that we're starting to get. We're getting asked from clients to be, quote unquote, help their planning be more data driven. We're getting asked from clients in terms of, you know, what's the best way to think about and how we should be planning our media tactics and our data usage given the upcoming regulation. So it's all been coming at the same time in terms of whether it's something that we were going to push forth ourselves versus the client asks itself. But the timing is quite good, especially during this period, I think, when, you know, clients have, some clients have lower marketing spend, but they have more, spending more time on evaluating their internal technology pieces and whether or not they're extracting all the value they can. So there's a little bit of both.
And from a sort of advising clients on, you know, the sort of the look and the function of their technology stack point of view, what's the sort of integration of marketing tech and ad tech looking like? The reason I'm asking is because I was having a chat with Scott Brinker, who runs a website called Chief MarTech. Chief MarTech, did I get that right?
Chief MarTech, yeah.
That's it. Yesterday, right? And he produces that MarTech Lumascape, which is, you know, even bigger and more complex than the AdTech Lumascape. And I was asking him, you know, whether he still gets asked, you know, by marketers and brands, hey, you know, what type of marketing tech solution or what type of tech do I need to do X? And he said, well, rowing back four or five years ago, yeah, I was asked that all the time. Like, I need to do this. What piece of tech can do that for me? He said, now it's much more of a full technology stack conversation. People will come to him and say, this is what our tech stack looks like. We're using this, and we use this here and that there. Am I missing something? Is there a gap in it? So I'm just interested because you probably have that conversation with clients both from a marketing tech and an ad tech point of view. Just interested if that is a similar trajectory. Are you noticing clients have got, you know, more of a full stack? And I'm using air quotes there because is it a full stack? Do they feel like things are missing?
Yeah, it's definitely a little, definitely, I would say. Yeah. So like more recently though, like a lot of our and work in this regard is helping, you know, brands navigate, I guess, the viability of their current stack, and or how to evaluate new pieces of tech, you know, in a world without third party cookies. And I think I alluded to this earlier, but we're in this weird kind of middle ground where we know, you know, that the third parties, we know it's going away and there's various alternative solutions that are being developed, but the exact, you know, deprecation day is, you know, not completely set. That's the solutions still being discussed. So it creates a conundrum for brands, you know, who are currently deploying a third party DMP. And we had clients come to us who are currently leveraging DMP solution, and maybe they don't feel they're getting as much out of it as they should. So in these cases, you know, we can provide consultation on how to extract more value, you know, via helping create a taxonomy, organizational structure, and then ultimately how to best activate. But, you know, it's a fair question to be asked during this time, is that whether or not brands should completely just move away from these solutions, like cookie-based solutions or even mobile device ID solutions without IDFA, you know, being hampered, and just focus on quote-unquote feature-proof solutions, right? I think the simple answer is yes. You know, why waste time on something that's going away? But I think, you know, as partners, there's definitely room for a bit more nuance. And again, I think I alluded to this earlier, but, you know, we don't know exactly when the cookie's going away. I think a lot of the talk coming from the folks in W3C is that there hasn't necessarily been tangible progress in putting actual proposals for testing within the sandbox solutions. So a lot of folks believe that the early 22 deadline is going to have to be pushed back, right? So on one hand, the timing could be longer, but even if everything goes according to plan, it's still 18 months. And there's not the future-facing solutions, especially in APAC, a lot of them, they're not necessarily at a point where they can drive a lot of value or scale yet. So like if we're going to use an analogy, let's say we have a bridge. You know, one side is 2010 ad tech. On the other side is 2020 ad tech, like, or non-cookie ad tech or whatever. And the bridge is where we are now. The town on the cookie side or the non-cookie side is being built as we speak. The houses and the apartments and condos aren't quite ready. There's a few, but it's not ready for everyone to move in there yet. And the shops aren't ready for business. You know, it wouldn't make sense to ferry everybody across the bridge and have them land there when there's nowhere to live, right? You don't want everyone to force everyone to no cookie town when it's not completely open for business. So in this case, our approach is that for these kind of clients, we're in this middle ground. You know, we help them extract maximum value from their existing tech while in parallel, you know, work with them to build a roadmap to ensure that, you know, they can cross that bridge when the time comes and that they don't lose out on current value they can generate, but still be prepared or as prepared for the future as they can be. Now for brands that don't have an existing investment or are just starting out, we're much more bullish in recommending like feature-based solutions for a get-go, right? So I think, you know, like you said, Rachel, like the space is rapidly shifting. So, you know, and it's fair to say that the stack itself will look a lot different next year. So like, I guess in the past you have a box in the center of a diagram and it says first party data and it's labeled DMP and then you have a bunch of arrows coming out, right? That's what it used to look like. And I think, you know, we've all probably drawn those in the past, but you know, that's not a very accurate representation of the current reality. So, you know, again, I don't think the DMP is dead, quote unquote, you know, but it's going to require significant evolution. I think that's already happening with existing DMPs developing more quote unquote CDP like features. Then you have next gen DMPs like Primitive, which I think is great, popping up. You know, and CDPs are getting a lot more shine right now, and for good reason. But I do think that all these acronyms are, you know, marketers don't really care what they're called. It's just, you know, does it do its job, right? So all these acronyms are going to collapse into one thing. I don't know what's going to be called yet. For a client with a lot of first party data across various owned and paid sources, you know, it probably makes sense to, you know, suggest a CDP type solution for now. And I think the other category that, you know, we have to consider for our clients and we're working on with our clients to consider is the role that cloud-based solution plays, right? So these days, like Google Cloud Platform, they're much more integrated with Google Marketing Platform. And, you know, there's more and more of these integrations between ad systems and cloud systems taking place. So, for example, marketers can use, you know, BigQuery machine learning tools within Ads Data Hub, you know, in the data clean room solution to, you know, create insights that are, you know, future-proof, right? So I think those sort of cloud data management applications and bringing that into the traditional kind of ad stack development discussion is it's something we're doing now, and it's quite important in terms of setting them up or setting ourselves and the client up for success in the future.
That is a really fascinating synopsis of what the journey from Cookie Town to non-Cookie Town potentially looks like. I'd love it if we can redraw the diagram with Cookie Town, non-Cookie Town, little truck, little van going over the bridge, you know, moving everyone from A to B.
Yes, that was the visual I had in mind. Lots of cookies cookie shops here, like different shops here, and just people on a bridge.
No, like it. Yeah. You can drive the van, Vince. Lindsay, any perspectives from your point of view?
I'm interested, you're talking about Cookie Town versus non-Cookie Town, and obviously referring to that as kind of future-facing solutions. What in your mind are future-proof solutions, in fact? What in your mind are, because we still aren't sure, you know, there's talk about contextual, there's talk about kind of unified ID. What to you at the moment represents these future-proof solutions for there being no third-party cookie? And, you know, for example, in non-Cookie Town, are they selling hoverboards versus skateboards? Like, how far ahead do you think we can go in terms of what we're promising future-proof solutions to clients?
I think the easy answer is, you know, something around persistent identifiers and using a customer data platform to get a single customer view and solve persistent, and then using an identity resolution partner to ensure that scales. I think that's the current answer. I think the answer I want to give is a little bit different, because I think it's something that it's a little bit left field, but I think it's something we're focusing on right now. And it's much more, in my opinion, actionable. I'll preface this by saying, because when people think of, and I'll frame this within, you know, the context of data-driven media planning, right? So a lot of folks, when they think of data-driven media planning, the first thing they think of is direct media addressability, especially in ad tech. You know, everything in terms of majority of discussions take place within the auction at the impression level. But I think one area that isn't, you know, especially within, you know, folks in programmatic and ad tech, they don't think about as much as the usage of data upstream at the comstrat phase to generate insights to inform downstream media tactics and strategy, or even further upstream, like pre-brief, and that's an area. And the reason why I think folks in ad tech may not play that space as much is because that's a space that's traditionally owned by brand strategists or business planners, right? And I think, you know, as we barrel towards Cookie Town or non-Cookie Town, you know, and likely a world without device IDs or a very limited version of it, and this goes back to what I was saying about breaking down silos, because I think there's a real opportunity to merge these spaces and leverage traditionally upstream aggregated data sources, like stuff from Ipsos, like GWA, that sort of thing, panel-based solutions, survey data, to augment and inform the usage of downstream programmatic era data sets in new ways, right? So, you know, in this way, you're connecting data from different levels in a single thread, because the paradigm around the way we're able to collect and deploy customer data directly, it's moving towards consent. It's important to remember that, you know, the older, more quote unquote older, more representative population data sets will not be disrupted at all, right? So in some ways, it's kind of a case of what's new, what's old is new again. And I'll give you an example of how this might work. So you have event level data that's generated from individual paid and earned media interactions. The data is, you know, narrow, but really deep and directly actionable. But it's also not very representative and, you know, carries relatively high bias because of the fact that it's narrow and deep. So what we can do and what we're doing now is creating frameworks where, you know, we're using population level data sets, you know, sourced from syndicated research or longitudinal studies and data at this level is more representative of larger audience groups, right? You know, it's not as programmable, nor is it as deep, but it's, you know, the bias is much less because it's representative. So what we can do is we can use that level of data to create a strategic sandbox within which it's safer to deploy event level data. And it works the other way around. Like declared user level data, first party data can be used to calibrate the more broader syndicated research. And, you know, that's something that we don't need a technology solution to facilitate. This is something that all exists now. It's just a matter of being creative about using the tools we have and you know, maybe rethinking the ways that traditionally agencies work in terms of how the different teams function. Mm.
Interesting.
That is really interesting. And that explains a little bit why, you know, you've got data strategy in your job title there, Vince, frankly. Very strategic point of view. I like it.
Yeah.
We've run out of time, so I'm going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much, Vince, for joining us. It was really good to, you know, have an Asian-focused conversation. And we look forward to hopefully seeing you in person again in Singapore sometime soon when the world is different and you can get on aeroplanes and fly from one side of the world to the other.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. It was a blast.
Not at all. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. That was this week's MedTech Podcast.